The final edition radio hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
I'm Tony Hendra, and welcome to the final edition radio hour. In this hour, I'll be celebrating with my doughty managing editor, Jeff Chrysler, the 30th birthday of everybody's favorite heavy metal band, our beloved chaplain, the Reverend John Hagee of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas, will explain why the Second Coming has a lot in common with the Second Amendment. And, yet again, we'll find out what's so exquisitely special about MSNBC. So hold on to your helmets and enjoy the final edition radio... Oh, my God. Ah!
Coming soon, the movie that somebody, somewhere decided is going to make billions. The ads are in the subway. They're on your TV. They're on every web page you click. You cannot escape this film. Liam Neeson, or somebody very much like him, in Panic.
There's a serial terrorist in this exclusive Beverly Hills high school, but there's no need to panic.
You don't want to see this movie. You really, really don't want to see this movie. But what the hell do you know? Have you studied the focus groups? Have you looked at the marketing data? Do you even read the trade papers? No, you don't. So shut up.
How are you holding up, Stella?
You mean, how am I handling my life as an attractive, tough-as-nails high school principal who's embarrassed about her history as a beauty queen and also never fired a gun and doesn't think she could ever fire a gun and doesn't think she ever will fire a gun, so why do we keep talking about it?
Is that your whole backstory?
Yes. Oh, and I have a deaf son.
Look out!
A hero being framed. A woman who you think might be the killer until you check what time it is and realize the film is only halfway through, so it can't be her. Big fight scenes. Long speeches condemning violence. Cars that crash into themselves. A baby that almost gets crushed by an aircraft carrier. Twice. The public is already sick of this movie, and it hasn't even opened.
I'm on the phone to my deaf son. I think he can hear me.
What?
Look out!
Panic. This film looks awful, and it is going to make a crap ton of money.
Hey, how's it going, music listeners? I'm Gabe Gibbons, and welcome to Indie World Beats. Today we have on our show a member of the most courageous punk band out there, a band that literally takes a beating for their music, Pussy Riot. Please welcome Nadezhda Tolokonnikova.
Здравствуйте.
Nadezhda, you and Pussy Riot have gone above and beyond as far as fighting to express your beliefs. You have served a prison sentence in Siberia, and recently all of you were whipped by Cossacks while performing at the Sochi Olympics.
Да.
So how do all of you continue while being punished so brutally for your convictions?
We like it.
You like it?
Да. When we were first sent to Siberia, we were subjected to all of the punishments that are included in a sentence in Siberia. You know, solitary confinement, forced labor, beatings. We all enjoyed it. Then we said, hey, why don't we kick it up a notch? So we went to Sochi, got a good whipping and some arm twisting. It felt nice.
When did you discover that you liked physical punishment?
We all saw the Jackass movie when we were younger and thought, that looks like fun. Why don't we do that? We didn't know we would enjoy it so much.
What's next on the Pussy Riot agenda?
A world tour. We want to see where else we can get a good beating, or worse.
Like where?
Somalia, finger crossed. Hopefully deep in mountains of Afghanistan where women aren't supposed to exist, the Saudi Arabia, and then hopefully deep in mountains of Tennessee where women aren't supposed to exist.
Aren't you afraid of something worse than a beating?
We should be so lucky. We would consider a beheading a great success.
Wow. You're hardcore.
No, just Russian.
Well, this has been Indie World Beats. I'm Gabe Givens. And join us next week where Iggy Pop will actually chop off his penis in hopes of one-upping Pussy Riot.
You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour. Hello, gorgeous. Fly you to the moon? I'm Richard Branson. That's Sir Richard to you. Welcome to Virgin's fab new interplanetary rocket line, Virgin Spacetime. Yes, duckies, Virgin Spacetime can now fly you to the moon. And I don't mean on gossamer wings. Fly in an obscenely luxurious ruling class stateroom. Feast on endangered species from doomed planet Earth. You gastronaut, you. Have gravity-free sex with one or more of our cool white moon goddesses. Natch, natch. Wink, wink.
Virgin Spacetime, making space available for everyone who's anyone.
This is MSNBC's Midday. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for being a part of my journey. I am your midday host, and my name still doesn't matter because I haven't been issued one by NBC. I'm hoping to get Martin Bashir's now that he's no longer using it. In any case, my first guest tonight is another MSNBC host whose name also doesn't matter.
Hello.
And we're joined by a new MSNBC host who is trying to sound like Rachel Maddow. And that's actually your name?
Yes, Daryl trying to sound like Rachel Maddow. I had it legally changed.
Well, you get your own name. Good for you. Tonight, we're going to talk about why Republicans are always racist, no matter what they do and no matter what the context. And guest number one, I want to start with you. Because when I was a little girl, I was walking to junior high, and I should mention I was two grades ahead, when I saw a black man being rejected for a home loan in the middle of the street in broad daylight. 2 years later, I was at Harvard, researching a thesis on race relations in a capitalist paradigm. And guest number one, my question to you is this. Do I actually seem to care what you think?
Well, I was actually watching Fox News when Sean Hannity came on wearing a red tie. And you know what? None of his guests called him out on his blatant racism.
Don't Republicans get it?
They just don't get it.
Why don't they get it? Let's put this to Daryl trying to sound like Rachel Maddow. Daryl, why don't Republicans get it?
Well, to explain that, let me first talk about an obscure district election for state assembly in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
Milt Summers is the leading Democratic candidate in District 39 near Carson City, but he's in a runoff election with Mike Stammers. Notice the similarity in the names.
Mm-hmm.
If voters cannot distinguish Summers and Stammers, it bodes ill for Democrats in the general election against the Republican Max Simmers.
Mm-hmm.
And the loss of a Democratic seat in the Nevada Assembly becomes a national issue if America repeals the 17th Amendment and starts electing U.S. senators through state legislatures as we did before 1913.
Interesting. Is this going anywhere?
No.
Hey, I just wanted to point out that I have many black friends, and you know, no two are exactly alike.
That is so true. That is so important. I am glad you said that. Well, just to round things out, we thought we'd have a little humor on the show. But we've been talking about race, so we can't make it too humorous. It's our top five list of secret racist code words or phrases Republicans use. Number five, Reagan. Number four, Lexus. Number three, Negroid. Number two, Big Mama Jamma. And the number one secret racist code word or phrase Republicans use is, I'm not racist.
That is great. That is hilarious. That top five list is exactly half as funny as a top ten list.
Can I just say that it was so hot today that I saw a dog chasing a cat and they were both walking. And that is a hate crime.
That is exactly right. Well, after the break, I'm going to call for a national conversation about national conversation. So stay right here.
It's time for our beloved chaplain, the Reverend John Hagee of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas, with another of his End Times God podcasts.
Today, the second coming. What will it look like? In a nutshell, the second coming
It's like the Second Amendment. It's all about guns. The guns of our blessed Savior, Jesus Christ, who died for our sins and rose again to kill the sinners. The Second Coming is about churning the sin-rotted guts of drug-sucking homosexual abortionists and lesbian stem cell farmers with copper-clawed black talon slugs pouring numberless as the stars from the white-hot barrel of his holy Glock. It's about BLU-109 fragmentation bombs, blowing atheistical private jet-set Hollywood commie fornicators and satellite radio blasphemic evolutionists into bite-sized buzzard snacks. It's about blasting wide the putrid fundaments of witch-worshipping, euthanasia-humping, child-cloning, hybrid-driving pornographers with space-based rectal rockets. It's about the agonized screams of the damned as they're chopped into bloody hamburger by our loving Savior in His infinite mercy.
We'll be right back after this with the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, a more perfect onion.
Come on down and see Elmo in Sesame Street Live's brand new show, Sesame Street Live, Coked Out Elmo.
Friends, how it, goddammit. Elmo needs to do a bump off her ass.
That's right. Elmo has developed an addiction, and we can't control the star of Sesame Street anymore.
We're not done. Elmo is not done. Elmo has more thoughts to express.
So see it live, where Elmo will alienate all of his closest friends.
Hold on, Abby. Elmo has 12 more stories for you. What was Elmo talking about? What the hell was Elmo talking about?
I have to go, Elmo. I really have to go.
Oh, yeah? Elmo would be a fantastic president. Here's why sandwiches. Yes, sandwiches. That's it.
And don't forget the abuse.
Zoe, you get over here, Zoe. You get the
bleep
over here. You
bleeping.
Dance.
But I don't dance in this song, Elmo.
You dance when Elmo tells you to dance.
And of course, come for the paranoia.
Big Bird is watching Elmo. He's always watching Elmo. Big Bird's just waiting for Elmo to surf up so he can have Big Bird's world. I'll slice him before he gets my fish.
So come on down to Sesame Street Live, Coked Out Elmo, now playing under a bridge near a creepy tunnel near you. Or in a prison as soon as it becomes Sesame Street Live, Coked Out and Really Violent Elmo.
Don't you look at Elmo! Don't you look at Elmo!
This portion of the Final Edition Radio Hour is sponsored by Starbucks, the fragrance.
Introducing Starbucks, the fragrance. Wake up and smell like coffee.
Caution, the fragrance you're about to use will make you extremely hot.
And now we return to our beloved chaplain, the Reverend John Hagee of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas, who will tell us more about where the Second Coming will occur.
Where will our shepherd do this? On the plain of Megiddo, in that holy land of milk and honey and tactical nukes, Israel. Will he be all meek and mild like Jesus 1? No way, Jose. Jesus 2 will be a mountain of a man. A mile high, an incredible holy hulk, Lieutenant J. Christ, USMC, capable of straddling nations, with one foot in Israel and the other 10,000 miles away in Europe, home of the Antichrist. All day, Judgment Day, from 9 to 5, Lieutenant Christ will cut down our enemies. 1 billion Muslims with leftover breakfast in their beards. 2 billion Hindus and Confucians with their shifty outsourcing steel-dumping ways and their foul fish breath. Multitudes without number of those sneering, snarling beasts of revelation, the Europeans. The filthy French will be hurled into God's mighty fondue pot to spend eternity up to their necks in boiling cheddar. The cross-dressing light and the loafer's limeys will be hurled into a burning closet to be buggered for all time by hippopotami high on Spanish fly. Lieutenant J.C. USMC will squish the terrorist coddling Danes and Dutch and Poles and Krauts and Czechs and Scots and Swedes into eternal red-hot road jam and make a moon roof in the head of Italy. Oh, happy day, that judgment day, when Christ Jesus will finally give genocide a good name. When we, the born again, the chosen, will watch his faith-based ethnic cleansing strip God's earth of sinful humanity, so we can safely graze with our beloved shepherd for 1,000 years of love, rejoicing, and private health care. Rejoice, America, for the Messiah is coming.
And now, episode 12 of Ken Burns' The Flame War.
Dearest Gilp, Thursday night, my companions and I ventured forth to the spaghetti boat on Route 12. As a cloud of mid-level Italian cooking benumbed our senses, a hostess named Aisha led us to a table that was at once both too close and too far from the bathroom. The waitress gave us menus after an interminable 7 minutes, then returned too soon for our order. We panicked that she would vanish into the fog if we betrayed any hesitation, made hasty, unready choices. Choices we would regret. She was also late with our soda. I give the spaghetti boat only 1 star, and fear I shall not be home by Christmas. Signed, Beauregard 26.
To my Yelp followers, my own experience at the spaghetti boat has been of a different complexion than for the aforeseen Beauregard 26. I find the salads fresh, the pasta endearing, and the breadsticks unlimited. Do not be misled by the traitorous and deceitful musings of Beauregard 26, who is taking spiteful revenge for perceived minor slights, and who reacted with resentment and dysphoria upon learning he was not the center of the spaghetti boat universe, and who is also a gaywad. I give Spaghetti Boat 5 stars. Sincerely, Rat Fart 3.
To all on Yelp who hear my cries, I impart a dire warning that the supposed Rat Fart 3, far from being an objective arbiter, is in fact a Spaghetti Boat employee, an ill-bred and churlish knave who attempted to clear our table while we still lingered in discussion of profound import. And who uses the word gaywad anymore? How old are you? With great concern, Beauregard 26.
Oh, Yelp. Beauregard 26 cried like a young maiden of first blush when informed we no longer serve the Bloomin' Onion. He is a soft product of private schooling and would not last 1 day as a waiter, and is still a gaywad. And I shall back that judgment with steel. Eternally, Rat Fart 3.
Yelp, my love. I have created 114 throwaway online identities, and they have all given this restaurant 1 star. I am Beauregard 26. P.S. If Ratfart and I truly are on opposite sides of this great civil conflagration, why do we both have southern accents?
That was episode 12 of Ken Burns' The Flame Wars. Tune in for episode 13, when Ratfart 3 delivers the immortal response that sets off the final battle.
Gaywad, 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 gaywad.
You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Hello, I'm Ted Cruz. You know, some of the greatest songs in the American folk song tradition are songs about disasters like floods or train wrecks. Now, I've written this little ditty as my contribution to that disaster song legacy. It's called The Train Wreck That Is the Old Obamacare. And it goes something like this. I see that train wreck coming. It's coming down the pike. Obamacare is something that I just don't like. But I'm stuck here in the Senate, and that is where I am. All I can do to stop it, read Green Eggs and Ham. When I was just a baby born in You Don't Worry Where, my family fled the horrors of socialized health care, and we came to a country where folks are free to die. When I hear about Obamacare, I hang my head and cry. There's poor folks living long and healthy lives, and income doesn't matter when it comes to who survives. I know about the benefits. I know some things are free. Now they're addicted to the sugar, and that's what tortures me. Train wreck and turn that train about, I'd ride it to the White House and kick that Kenyan out, and we live in a paradise for the ruling class. And if you can't afford insurance, then you can kiss my ass.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, a more perfect onion.
And now for a special Final Edition Radio Hour interview. As most of our listeners probably know, this is the 30th anniversary of the release of the seminal film of our generation, or at least one very good movie, and that is This Is Spinal Tap. This Is Spinal Tap was a satire of the music industry, or perhaps it was more than that. We'll find out when we talk to Tony Hendra, who our listeners know as both the co-producer and co-star of the Final Edition Radio Hour, and as the man who played Sir Ian Faith, the band manager in Spinal Tap.
I don't think Ian has been knighted.
As just regular Ian Faith, a man who should have been knighted. Spinal Tap, to me, it was Spinal Tap, Monty Python, Holy Grail, and Animal House. Those are my three movies.
The Trinity.
Of my growing of comedy age, I guess it was. Although Animal House always stuck in my mind more because there was a brief boob scene. But nonetheless, those are my comedy movies.
I would say that Animal House, it does fit in that in the Trinity,
sure,
because it is actually it got a sort of bad rap in a way because it became seen as a gross out movie with toga parties thrown in.
It became people think of it as the frat movie, much like they think of Calvin and Hobbes as Calvin pissing on things when it's deeper.
Exactly. Yes, its reputation was determined by its imitators,
mm-hmm.
and And actually, it was a very potent satire of further education in the United States. I mean, with the Dean Wormer, who's essentially Nixon, mm-hmm. who screws around with the Constitution of Faber College, and the ROTC, which is essentially the military, and so forth and so on. So but all of that was kind of lost under the welter of food fights and toga parties.
But no, it obviously resonated for more than just a brief boob shot with me. As did Spinal Tap. I don't think there were any boob shots. There was talk of greased up women on all fours, but indeed, never any shots. Spinal Tap is in a short list of movies, I won't bother pretending to remember them, that has, I think, lasted sort of the test of its time. It's been 30 years. And I think it still resonates, even with people that didn't experience sort of what it was perhaps on one level speaking to, which is sort of coming out of the 60s and into the 70s and into this the 80s looming sort of corporate era of music and everything, and making fun of those types of bands, and yet people still relate to them even if they never knew any of those elements. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's actually for several reasons, but one of the reasons I'd like to discuss tonight a bit is one that isn't, I don't think, talked about very much, which is that Spinal Tap is on the sort of primary level a scathingly funny parody of the fecklessness and mindlessness of heavy metal. But on a deeper level, it seems to me, it is a satire. I mean, because it's a satire, actually, of an entire system, of the lifestyle, of its assumptions, its personnel, that helped to make the likes of Spinal Tap the cultural nadir it was. Or as one NYU cultural studies course taught by a very, very serious cultural studies professor called Andrew Ross once put it, Spinal Tap and the decline of Western civilization.
Is that a cause and effect?
Well, yes, apparently, according to Andrew Ross, who is a Scot, by the way, in a very left-wing book, left-wing Scot.
Was that, maybe you can tell me, is that because Spinal Tap finally said the emperor has no clothes and everything fell apart?
I think Spinal Tap was the meme, maybe, or the trope, or the tropey meme, or the meme trope.
The Trim.
Yeah, the Trim.
That was that movie.
So, anyway, so we have the parody, obviously wonderfully carried off by the group itself, of these lampoons of heavy metal's musical subgenres with all their kind of idiotic priapism. But obviously the lampoons, the parodies are brilliant, and yeah, they're brilliant not only because of their ridiculous sexual memes, but because of their pretension. I think it's one of the things that Spinal Tap caught wonderfully was the pretension of heavy metal. Christopher Guest's character Nigel Tufnell, who is basically the most moronic of the three morons who front Tap, is also its most moronically pretentious with his wonderful work in progress, his trilogy in D minor,
yes,
which has the working title of Lick My Love Pump.
His pretension is what led into the great, like, this one goes to 11 scene. It shattered his, he was professing such grand ambitions.
And of course, actually, Stonehenge is immensely pretentious too. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of gone down in film history as an epic stage fail, but really its lyrics and effects are just as funny, because they perfectly embody that kind of awful, flaccid, Lord of the Rings-driven, Celtic, Nordic, Aryan race memory fantasies, you know, that heavy metal loves to wallow in.
Well, it fits in also to that thing that they have earlier about having all the appealing to all the male teenagers as their audience.
Right.
I forget if that was in the scene when he had the
ocean of retarded sexuality. But the thing is that surrounding these wonderful parodies is this kind of 360-degree satire of the industry which brought us rock and fed off it, both while it was alive and well, and when it was a fly-blown corpse. And basically, no rock, if you'll forgive the expression, is left unturned during Tap's pathetic journey. And all the slimy things under each one of them are given ample room to slime themselves into movie legend. You mentioned Fran Drescher, whose character name is Bobby Fleckman,
mm-hmm,
and she has that wonderful sort of New York, whiny New York voice.
Perfect little publicist-ish type. I forget that was exactly her role. But
I mean, she's certainly a part of the slime monument that is Polymer Records. And then there's Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg, of course, who is founder of Hogwood, which is a summer camp for pale young boys, and even Howard Hessman. I don't know if Howard Hessman.
Yeah, he was
played the Terry Ladd.
He was the manager of the other band, right? That they came across. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. In Memphis, and the star was Duke Fame. Mm. And Duke Fame had been one of the many, many members of Spinal Tap. And what was great about that scene was that Duke Fame is equally talentless. I mean, he's just as much a sort of bottom feeder as Tap is. But he happens to be on the upswing. So Howard Hessman won't let Spinal Tap touch him. And then he sort of gets out of an awkward situation.
How are you, laddie? Great to see you, Terry. Terrific to see you.
Liam.
But I think my favorite is Paul Schaefer's Artie Fupkin, the A&R guy in Milwaukee or wherever it is. But he shows up at the record store and eventually, having tried to blame the owner of the record store for the fact that none of the public has shown up, actually blames himself in this marvelous burst of passive aggression and says,
I'm not asking, I'm telling with this. Kick my ass.
One of the reasons why there's never been a sequel or, in fact, an effective imitation of it is that it was very much of a certain moment. And I think everybody in the movie was sort of, in some either superficial or profound way, disappointed with rock and roll. And it was that moment where you still sort of could remember caring about it enough that you were actually disappointed. It's that totality of the picture, I think, that makes the movie so interesting. Everybody in the movie contributes to that sort of world. And in that way, I think it's a satire. I mean, I would say it's a satire comparable, at least in its scope and its success, to Dr. Strangelove, which has the same kind of, it totally creates a world where logic is absent, completely absent.
So we're talking about slime balls. And I got to say, having now worked in entertainment some, if that's what I've been doing for the last million years, is your character resonates even more because you, as the band manager, have a unique sliminess that is sort of, you sort of have to tell lies to everybody in order to keep moving forward until, like, you can no longer lie anymore. When you sort of conceptualize your character, was liar part of one of the big words that drove it, or
well, no, I didn't. I mean, I didn't really think about it very much until, well, that's not quite true. I mean, I figured or modeled what I was going to do with this character on a guy called Andrew Lou Goldham, but he was the manager of the Rolling Stones, and he was very much, I mean, he was sort of blonde, two-faced kind of fellow, and with a much more pucker, upper-class kind of accent than his Scotney East End of London charges.
Right.
So that seemed to be a fairly good model. But I must say, as soon as I started improvising, I remember it exactly. It was the scene at the beginning of the movie when they're in the limousine, and Ian is lying from the first moment he opens his mouth. He says the New York Times is going to do something, and then he says, "Well, we're not doing anything very much in New York because it's not worth it." But Philadelphia is a big rock town. It's just right from the start. He's making excuses for things before they happen.
One of the things I always thought was interesting about Ian's character is that he, like you said, he'll say, "Oh, the New York Times is going to do something," and then he undercuts it. It struck me that he was the type that would always say something good, even if a second later contradicted it. And in part, that was not just him lying, but him dealing with other characters, his charges, as you say, who are probably of the type of sociopath that only will hear the good things. That he kind of relied on being able to say, "I'm going to give you $1 million." "No, I'm not." And all they heard was, "I'm going to give you $1 million," because they want to believe the best about themselves.
Right, exactly. But one of my favorite scenes, actually, is the scene where Nigel is worried about the food, the backstage food.
Oh, yeah. And
Ian is very... he's very attentive. You know, he's not lying. He's actually trying to help poor moronic Nigel fold the meat around the bread in such a way that it might be edible. But then, you know, when Nigel starts getting worked up, he says, "I don't want you to ruin your performance," you know. And he means it. Nigel's all he has, you know. And he's all Nigel has. But you're right. Ian is a slime ball, and I did it brilliantly.
What do you think about Ian's role, or other people's role in the movie, as far as, like, sort of the corporatism of either looming corporatism of music or just in general, because in a way, Ian, even though he's son of a slime ball, he is management. I mean, he's their manager, so he himself sort of has a corporate element.
That's what I'm saying. I think is one of the reasons it has a kind of universal appeal, and a continuing appeal because as you say, those slime balls are still with us and they're still screwing us and they still run the show. And the fact is that the record company hovers sort of invisibly over the whole movie. It's not just in the occasional characters that show up from the record industry. I mean, and often Ian's job is simply to be the messenger of that. I mean, when he produces the Black Album, which doesn't even have their name on it, you know, and tries to enthuse about it, we're finally on our way, you know.
There is sort of this element of the corporation or the record company as God. Like, it's sort of Ian is struggling there, having to lie. But there's a sense that if the company really wanted to get behind it, they can make a star. I mean,
they could make it into Duke fame overnight if they wanted to.
Right, yeah. And yet that doesn't happen. And
right. I go back to this, the idea that you've just expressed, because it came out like in the height of the Reagan years, right? I mean, it came out in 1984 when sort of unchained capitalism and greed is good, was really roaring, and the corporations had sort of almost overnight, from being the villains of the piece in the 60s and 70s, were now the heroes. But I think this might be one of the reasons, if I'm right, this might be one of the reasons why, and I can reveal this now on our show.
Reveal it.
That the principles of this incredibly successful movie, I mean, one thing you can say about it is that it's not only been pretty successful all over the English-speaking world, and indeed in parts of the non-English-speaking world, like Germany and France, all the money that presumably has been taken in by somebody, in fact by a number of corporations, more than half a dozen actually, over the 30 years, not one cent of that has been enjoyed by the principals of the movie. No profit participation, although all of us had contracts guaranteeing profit participation. Not one cent of that has been seen. So they got their revenge, the corporation.
That's kind of amazing. And you did have contracts that said you get back. I mean, I know, look, Hollywood reporting, quote unquote, is making sure that every expense just goes in lockstep with every piece of income. But that's kind of ridiculous.
The budget for this movie?
It was, what, like $12? I mean,
$4 million. Okay. Right. $4 million. It's probably one of the lowest budget, massive hit movies ever. And if... There comes a point where if a movie costs $4 million and it continues to make money for 30 years, there's going to be some profit there somewhere.
I do have a law degree, and I'm a member of the California Bar, but I don't think I'm going to be the best guy.
I think we ought to go on as a sort of poor little Spinal Tap, you know, and go on Kickstarter and see if we can get enough money to really slap them. That's
well, would you raise money to fund a lawsuit, or would you just raise money to pay yourself?
Because that's right. Why give it to the middleman? Yeah. Just don't call me Liam.
That was Tony Hendra, who played Sir Ian. I keep saying Sir Ian. I want you to be a sir. Ian Faith in Spinal Tap, or This Is Spinal Tap, with not just some interesting artistic and creative insights, but also a legal bombshell. That's it.
Welcome back to the conclusion of the Final Edition Radio Hour, A More Perfect Onion. It looks like we might make it after all.
The Final Edition now presents an interview with TV writer Jim Earle about his podcast, 30 Minutes of Crap, which he performs twice monthly with his former writing partner at The Daily Show, Steve Rosenfield. Jim, I know you have a lot of interesting show business credits and a lot of stories about The Daily Show, but I wanted to focus on the podcast, which takes on some of the top current events of the day. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
No, thank you, Barry, for having me on. Sure. And, of course, yeah. Steve and I have been doing the podcast, 30 mm-hmm. Minutes of Crap, for a couple of months now, and we've only had about three or four editions. So
yeah, right. So.
Hey, you know, before I go on, can I tell everybody where I'm going to be appearing in the next week?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, this won't take long. I'll be at Shenanigans Tuesday, G. Willikers on Wednesday, Holy Cows on Thursday, Zoinks on Friday, Jeepers on Saturday, Jumpin' Jehoshaphats on Sunday, and back at Cramming Up Your Asses on Monday.
Okay.
All week I'll be at Farter's Laugh Oven the next week in Stockton, except for Thursday when I'll be at the Laugh Ginch with a Friday one-nighter at Gaber's Ass Flume in Lodi. Oh. Raffle afterwards.
Okay.
Then I'll be at Snickers Snark Shack in Van Nuys, Carver's Laugh Culvert in Culver City, Latifah's Def Jam and Race Comedy Riot in Compton, yep. and Shit in Shitsville, just off the 134.
Sure. Okay.
Then I'll be at Hitler's Laugh Oven in Pittsburgh. Toronto's Ha Ha Hogan and Tempe, Hogan's Tempe Tonto and Ha Ha, Tempe's Hogan Ha Ha and Tonto, Ha Ha's Tonto Tempe and Hogan, yeah. Shem's Palace of Gluten in Berkeley, Dr. Brown's Abortion on Demand Chuckle Cave and Incest Emporium, and I'm holding Michael Jackson's Penis Comedy Magic Club in Brentwood.
Yeah. So when you
week after that, I'll be gigging at Mom and Dad Are Disappointed in Me in My Mind,
okay.
Florida.
Okay.
Ball Slaps in Bend, Oregon. Vagina's Oyster Hut in Eureka. That's
sure.
a great place.
Oh, yeah.
And they just shot the president in Dallas.
Hmm.
So that's a good week, good 3 weeks.
Well, that's, so you're still out there working as a comedian. That's
the week great. After that, I'll be appearing at Bonkers Hurt Cellar, Insaney's Ass Attic, Looney's Torture Loft, mm-hmm. and Peanuts' Pecan Hutch, all at the Saugus Ramada Inn.
Yeah. Okay.
Then I'm at Farter's Fuck Stop in Fayetteville,
oh.
Dr. Mengele's Joke Lab, Skinny's Colon Hut and Crap Haven.
Oh, that's still running. Okay.
Yeah. Followed by Fatty's Dump Factory in Fairfax, mm-hmm. Buster's Butt Your Gut Butt Bong and Tattoo. Tattoo Shoppy in Baldwinsville, and Flipper's Jerk Sock Emporium in Snatch Bend, Illinois.
Oh, I remember that place.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour.
Conservatives tell us that many supposedly antiquated social customs liberals rail against should be respected as traditional American values that go back to colonial times, a better and more innocent era. Well, let's see.
Good morrow, Harriet the basket maker.
Good morrow, Lily the dairy maid. 'Tis a fine day, is it not?
Aye, me lady, 'tis fine indeed. How does the day find your husband, Ian the jobless?
He is helping Theodore the abusive with his cattle.
Grand! And what brings you to the market on this glorious morning?
I've come to acquire fine herbs from Eli, the fine herb grower, and hold court with Alexandria.
Alexandria the tall, or Alexandria the short?
Nay, Alexandria the medium.
Ah, the psychic girl.
Indeed.
I haven't seen her in a fortnight. 'Twas the engagement party of Harold the black chicken plucker and Gertrude the frequently married, I think it was.
I heard tale of that rowdy evening. I did hear that Toby, the heavy drinker who always blubbers over losing his dog Spot in a wagon accident, that he... Well, he did that again at the party.
Oh, yes, I blame he who brought the ale, nondescript Xavier, who does nothing. I guess he would just be Xavier, then.
Hello!
Ah, 'tis Marcus the fudge packer come to flaunt his goods at market.
Who wants fudge?
I swear by the noonday sun, Marcus the fudge you pack is the best to be found both far and wide.
Indeed, with every bite I feel so wonderfully gay.
'Tis what they all say. Know you this? Harold the black chicken plucker was heard to have said he was not fond of how I pack fudge. But just a few weeks ago, I caught him in the rear of my outfit with a coy smile and fudge betwixt each of his fingers. Methinks he secretly covets my fudgy goodness.
But Marcus, Harold the black chicken plucker, who's betrothed to Gertrude the frequently married, both packed their own fudge for their engagement party a fortnight ago. We were all there to watch. 'Twas his own lady's fudge betwixt his fingers.
Well... good for Harold the black chicken plucker and Gertrude the frequently married, then. Doth he intend to put me out of fudge packing? A plague on his ass.
Come now, Marcus, one should not speak ill of a man's ass, nor his sow, nor his cock.
I shall speak ill of Harold the black chicken plucker's whole farm, including his cock, which is often premature, waking me before the sun even rises. Harold's cock be the biggest pain in my rear. I have seen his cock with mine own eyes, and it beeth small and weak, and doth spread its seed fruitlessly.
Behold the finest fabrics. Get your exquisite silks and brocade here.
God balls! I do believe 'tis Leroy, the homosexual.
Good day, my ladies. Check out this marvelous poplin.
Oh, poplin.
Good day, Marcus the Fudge Packer. Dost have some fudge packed for me today?
That I do, Leroy. Eat thy fill. Stop thyself, silly.
So, when you first started the podcast...
The week after that, I'll be at Remembrance of Things Laughed.
Oh.
The Grapes of Laugh, The Telltale Har Har Heart, Mirth of the Nations, Don Kijoki's,
okay.
The Scarlet Laughter,
mm-hmm.
The Brothers Laugh Your Ass Off,
yeah.
The Great Laughsbees,
sure.
Laughter in the Rye,
yeah.
Slaughterhouse Type 5,
okay.
The Postman Always Zings Twice,
yeah.
The Magnificent Laughtersons,
okay.
Battlefield Mirth,
yeah.
All's Hilarious on the Western Front,
mm.
50 Shades of What the Hey, King Solomon's Lines, and Uncle Tom's Laughing.
Hmm. Okay.
And a Journey to the Center of the Mirth.
Okay.
Oh, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Glee. That's a funny place.
Yeah.
It's only been open a week.
Really? Huh. So you're, I mean, you're really having a
month after that, I'm at Larry's Laugh Laundromat in Squid Hatchery in Salinas. The Laugh Out Lounge, oh my God, it's rolling on the floor, laughing my asses off, emoticon smiley face and boner hut lap dance circus and huffer hut,
mm-hmm.
Barney's Burford Barn, Floater and Sinker's Flush Funtorium in Fontana,
mm-hmm.
Put Your Hands Together in Gary's Guffaw Garage, What's That Running Down Your Legs, Dr. Mangala's Comedy Clinic, Flippers Funtopia and Thalidomide Dispensary,
mm-hmm.
Belly Laughs,
yeah.
Bananas Boner Basement, and I'm not even trying anymore, it's Giggletorium and Scab Drop-Off Center. Oh, and the week after that, I'm at the Triangle Funwaste Factory.
Okay. Well, I'd hope to talk a little bit more about the podcast, but we are out of time.
That's a drag.
Any credits? Where are you going to be next?
Oh, well, I'll be at Larry's Laugh Laundromat and Squid Hatchery in Salinas. It's kind of like a 6-month run.
Oh, okay.
So, here, I'll start at the very beginning.
Okay,
again.
All right.
I'll be at Shenanigans Tuesday, June.
Coming this fall, another show to make you hate being American. From the makers of Duck Dynasty comes Hillbilly Dentist.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
Hi, I'm from out of town, and I have a dental emergency. The guy at the gas station suggested I come here.
You never should have come here in these parts.
What?
I get the sawbones. Here's it, right? We got one!
Hi, I'm Dr. Zeg. You never should have come here in these parts.
Hi, how are you? I think I got an impacted molar. Are you sure you're a dentist? I mean, this place doesn't look fully licensed.
Frog spit. We're fully qualified for any sort of healing. Nurse Lizzie, please fetch my assistant.
He's get your smelly buddy in here and tell the others.
This here is my half-wit brother. He's the shame of the family. And also a highly qualified dental hygienist. Say howdy, Dr. Zug.
Well, what do we got here? Looks like a city feller. You never should have come here in these parts.
Dr. Zug, may I confer with you for a spell? Hey, Zug, he ain't got no hair on his face.
I know. He ain't got no facial hair.
Now, city feller, open wide. Uh-oh. Looks like you got gingivitis.
You mean I have gum disease?
Hell no, you got gingivitis.
Gone too far. I demand to see your boss.
You want to talk to the boss? Here, I'll go get the boss. Hi, I'm the boss. Who's been calling me?
You know, I just did.
You know better than to interrupt me during the chicken ritual.
Hey, boss.
Hi, Mom.
No, I'm your mom.
I'm leaving. You people are nothing but inbred hayseeds with no qualifications whatsoever for proper dental care.
Do scream!
Kill them and eat them!
Whimsical little yarn if it ends there, right? But there are many more endings to choose from. Please, spin the magic wheel of endings to discover where fate can lead us. The city feller thinks he is a chair.
Sit on me! I'm a genuine Louis XIV! You don't like me because I'm made from rare Brazilian teak wood.
The gum disease joke is reversed.
Open wide, city feller. Uh-oh, looks like you got gum disease.
You mean I've got gingivitis?
Hell no, you got gum disease.
The city feller discovers he has chanced upon a rural enclave of erudite Shakespearean actors.
Our purses shall be proud. Our garments poor.
For 'tis the mind that makes the body rich.
And as the sun breaks through the darkest clouds,
so honor appeareth in the meanest habit.
Yeah!
The hayseeds turn out to be friendly squirrels in search of nuts.
You mean I have gum disease?
Next tab. Hillbilly High Yield Municipal Bond Fund Manager.
This has been another Final Edition Radio Hour. To get your fill of more satire with teeth, visit thefinaledition.com every single day. Today's show was performed by Kevin Janis, Barry Link, Darby Worley, Jim Earle, Anne Tuchel, John Marshall, Rob Gordon, Jen Dodd, Andrew Hammond, Rachel Rauch,
Abby Parker,
Jeff Chrysler, and Tony Hendra. Written by Barry Link, John Marshall, Jim Earle,
Jen Dodd,
Jeff Chrysler, and Tony Hendra. Edited by Greg Russ, Andrew Hammond. Produced by
West Coast Barry Link, East Coast Mothership,
Jeff Chrysler, and Tony Hendra. The Final Edition Radio Hour is a production of The Final Edition, LLC. Copyright 2014.